C1P. Number 11B.
Yes, we come to a fourth point, you see. We just go always a little step further. So, a fourth point, after having said abandon the belief, then you are left, so to say, in a vacuum. But that is not a solution to stay in a vacuum. You have abandoned the belief, so what do? You begin to fill now this vacuum. Fourth point is lifting thought above error or disease. You see another rule of soul, lifting thought now above error or disease. And therefore contending persistently for truth. See, now we come really into the healing aspect where the truth aspect is taken in. So we fill up that whole emptiness in thought and fill it up with truth. So we contend really persistently for truth. Then she takes in a further little step and says that now this truth for which you contend and which you hold in your consciousness, that should naturally now be projected on the patient. Therefore, she has a further point as saying, now we must address the disturbed mind with this truth. So you begin to see that that truth is a remedy for that disturbed mind, and that that disturbed mind naturally is no reality and has no power and has no way of acting. And so you begin to express a kind of fatherhood sense, the true method of healing, by projecting on the case really that truth. Then she has another point, which she takes up, a sixth point, and says, and while you do that, that may cause some kind of chemicalization. That faith in the truth of being, she says, that faith in that truth of being, which we really project on the situation, may occasion a chemicalization. It may occasion, it must not. So we don't have to expect always a chemicalization, it must not. Why, she says, because the truth of being must transform the error. So you can see that addressing the patient's disturbed thoughts at that fifth point can bring at the sixth point some kind of a turbulence, a chemicalization, a crisis, because error may not yield so willingly as we would like to see it. So she explains that process of chemicalization and says chemicalization is the upheaval produced when immortal truth is destroying erroneous mortal belief. So again we see that chemicalization here is a positive sign and says it's a transitionary period when error begins to yield to the impact of truth. And then she brings in a seventh point, namely the supremacy of mind. Now you really get to the climax of it. And here she says in various ways, she says, we must acknowledge the supremacy of divine mind. Now we have really left now all the sense of mortal mind, and now to accept the supremacy, soul, of divine mind. The action of the so-called mortal mind must be destroyed by the divine mind, see? And therefore we should admit the efficacy and supremacy of mind. So it's now acknowledging the efficacy and supremacy of mind. Or she says, immortal mind and its formation must be apprehended. It's no more a question that mortal mind does this and that and the other, and that we should correct mortal mind with this and that and the other and so on. Now you really reach the synonymous term where you really go out from the synonymous term, from mind, and that the immortal mind and its formation must be apprehended. The life of man, she says, is mind. See, it's beautiful to see that she doesn't say the life of man is God life. She says the life of man is mind, because the whole subject was, is mortal mind really maintaining man's life or destroying man's life? And so her answer is, no, mortal mind can do nothing. It's only the divine mind that is responsible for the life of man. Yes. So, can you see now how, if one analyzes the text and asks oneself, now what are the steps in consciousness that we have to take, or at least to see and to realize, when we see that truth as soul is controlling the body, that we don't take that just as a statement, as a true statement, and say, Mrs. Eddy says that truth controls the body, that we ask ourselves, well, how is that possible? Therefore, we ask the scientific reasoning about it. How is that possible? A question I'm sure that many, many ask you and say, but how is that possible, that truth that does not know error, that truth that does not know the body, truth that does not know disease, how then can truth really heal a disease? So we have to analyze it. Let's just quickly go over these 7 points. You see, she starts out and says, well, mortal mind is that which produces the disease. Therefore, second, mortal mind and the body are one, or mortal mind and disease are one. Therefore, third, so to say, abandon, therefore, mortal mind. If mortal mind is no good at all, then the next thing is abandon mortal mind. But don't leave the whole situation in emptiness, in a vacuum. Fill it up with something. So the fourth point comes in and says, yes, lift your thought above error, so that you are really living in a realm of truth, and contemplate now truth. But don't contemplate truth just for yourself. Make a further step, 5, and therefore project that truth to the disturbed mind, so that that truth is actually the Savior, the Christ, to that disturbed mind. Don't leave that patient alone with his trouble and so on. So project that truth to the case and begin to see that whole case from the point of view of truth. At the 6th point, she said, and if by doing that, the patient doesn't quite react on it, perhaps resists it a little bit, that may give a crisis, but don't be disturbed about that crisis. The control of truth is still going on, and little by little that resistance will yield. And when it yields, it begins to heal. So that actually, as a last point, one begins to realize that only the divine mind is the only factor in healing, that the divine mind has actually the supremacy over mortal mind, and therefore over mortal mind and its body. So, I feel if one understands this clearly, one can answer anyone properly and intelligently when they ask that question about how does truth affect the body. Yes. I think this part is most important because it gives somehow, perhaps the only time here really in the chapter on practice, so to say, a short illustration of how you deal in treatment with a case in a practical way. See, I think it's here that we find some kind of a confirmation of what John Dolly used to teach us all along, namely as his method of treatment. Anyway, as a starting point for his method of treatment. He usually had some kind of an abbreviated method. He said, if you have a case, then the very first thing you should do is to put that whole case behind you in a corner. See, not to make anything out of it. To put that whole thing way back into a corner. And then he said, and then turn around, 180 degree around, and look exactly in the opposite direction. Look then into the infinitude of mind, to the supremacy and infinitude of mind, capital M. And then, from that point, go on. Actually, then he began to show from that point on, which what is not in here, that naturally then he said, what do you have gained if you go out from the supremacy of mind? Then he says, then contemplate what mind has to tell you. And so begin to contemplate that the, so to say, the divine mind reading, mind knowing only ideas. Therefore, knowing man only as idea. Knowing man only as idea, as the idea of mind, as the idea of spirit, as the idea of soul, of principle, of life, truth and love. And so you establish in your consciousness really the fact about man. That's here truth, the fact about man. And that fact about man through divine mind reading would always, through the law of opposite, uncover the specific error that need to be dealt with. So that we never draw our conclusion from the disease, from the symptoms, from the diagnosis. We never draw our conclusion from anything else but from what mind tells us, from what mind tells us as ideas. And every idea, you know that very well, every idea has within itself that Christ activity that through the law of opposite will uncover the very specific error. Just as a cultured consciousness of music will always, through the law of opposite, detect an error in music. We don't need to know the errors. We only need to know the truth. We only need to know the harmony of music. And that harmony of music by itself will always bring to the front when something is not in accord with that harmony. And so we say, oh, the violin played that and that tone wrongly. He didn't quite get that tone and so on. So the error is always detected by the truth. And so we can see here that Mrs. Eddy at this point would show is those first two steps that John Dolly explained, namely first put the whole case behind you so that you don't see it, don't argue with it, that you don't talk with the error and with the pains and so on, and turn towards the supremacy of mind. Now this is explained here in this passage in more detail, because it starts out with mortal mind and begins to reason that the problem is just mortal mind, and then that second point shows that mortal mind and the body is one. And then at the third point says, therefore, let go of the beliefs of mortal mind. That's the point where Chandoli said, put it behind you and out of your sight. The fourth point then would be a turning towards the right, beginning to fill up the vacuum with the truth of being until you see that the only truth of being is really the supremacy of mind itself. What he said, that's the second step, to see the infinitude and to look into the infinitude of mind. So here I think the this text here, you see, would answer why should all his advice be reasonable. Is that, you see, somebody could come along and say, well, Chandoli says, if you practice, the very first thing is put your problem behind you into a corner and then look into infinitude of the mind. They could say, well, isn't that a bit an ostrich policy, just putting your head into the sand and say, I don't want to see error, which could look like that. And here Mrs. Eddy would just show the smaller steps, the little steps, to prove that this is a right method. That this is a right method, but that we naturally would have to understand why this method is right. I like this part very much about truth and soul, giving really the detailed explanation of how really truth is able to destroy sickness. See, that's so important to see the method of practice. You see, here she, as I said, she doesn't really, in the whole chapter, tell us how to deal with a specific case in a specific way. How to deal with a kidney disease, how to deal with a heart attack, how to deal with stomach trouble, how to deal with a broken bone, how to deal, I don't know with what, with whatever the disease is called. She always gives only the fundamental method, because if disease is only mortal mind, you can put any kind of disease always into the same pot, namely mortal mind. We never really have to deal with a specific case of disease. We always have to deal with mortal mind. How do we deal with mortal mind? Only through the divine mind. What is the divine mind? The divine mind is mind, the divine mind is spirit, the divine mind is soul, the divine mind is principle, is life, truth and love. And so you fill your consciousness really with the whole of God, and in that wholeness of God, there is certainly, every case is certainly included there, and you cover it with your synonymous terms. That, I think, is fundamentally what Chandoli always wanted to bring out. It is interesting, he taught that method of practice long, long ago. I remember when I went through class, he already taught it therefore long ago, before he presented the chapter on practice as he did in 1950, and then the book was brought out as a verbatim report, long before he could sense that method of dealing with a problem. And that is, I think, should be that what the reader of John Stolle's book on the practice should really see, that he was trying to show a method and not telling what kind of healings he had. The healings were only illustrations of the method, and that method was always the same. It was always the same. So, in a way, I think I always see that that book of John Dolly is so misunderstood by the reader. It is a book that sells quite well, that mostly the practitioner in the church buys somewhere through a roundabout way to get hold of it. But It really hurts me to think that they read it as a recipe book and just have a sense where does Mr. Dawley tell something about the stomach trouble, where does he say something about the heart attack, how did he treat with a liver complaint or a gall disease or whatever it is. That's exactly what he doesn't want to say in that book. See? And very seldom one sees that the student who reads that wonderful book, and where John Dawley has given this wonderful layout of this chapter, the layout of the chapter is not from me, as you know from the study material, that I have taken the rough structure from him. He has seen for the first time those four parts very clearly. All what I have done, I have put the subtones in it, and now I explain it a bit from that standpoint. But the real great contribution that he gave with that book was actually the system of that book, the layout of that book, and then to show that there is one great method underlying all healing, and that the student really should get acquainted with that and not read over the pages where he explains the theory and then only stop there where he says, I once had a case, so and so and so, then I was dealing with it, so and so and so. That is not the important thing. These are only the examples. We cannot learn the method of healing through reading the examples. We can only learn the method of healing through the theory that he presents in the book. And so the same, that what impresses me so much in this chapter in the textbook, that she doesn't show how to heal a specific case with a specific name of disease. She doesn't. Thank God. She gives us the theory of it and says, this theory is so fundamental that with that theory you can practice in every case. Yes, that's here the tone of truth as soul. So we come to the next tone of truth as principle. And here at once we feel that a different subject is discussed. She leaves now that question of the rule of soul, and here she takes up, really, again, metaphysics or science versus a wrong sense of metaphysics, namely voluntary and involuntary mesmerism. Our epitome that we have here is governing ourselves through science. Voluntary and involuntary mesmerism cannot touch us. In other words expressed, we could say, if we govern ourselves through science, through divine metaphysics, through science, then any other ism cannot govern us. Then voluntary and involuntary mesmerism or hypnotism or whatever you want to have can no more govern us, can no more touch us. So we are considering really the government of our body through science versus mesmerism. And it is also here an interesting point that she brings up. She reasons in the following line. She says that mesmerism or hypnotism is not scientific. So she makes a distinction first between science and mesmerism. We say, as a proposition, we say that one human mind can influence another and in this way affect the body. So she brings up the theories or other theories that exist and say, well, there are quite a few theories how you can affect the body. You can heal the body and affect the body through mental means, through mesmerism, through hypnotism, through spiritualism. Well, today she would have to need a whole page to enumerate all the various mental, metaphysical, and semi-metaphysical ways how today people try to influence the body and govern the body. At that time it was usually just mesmerism, and then it was just a little bit hypnotism that was known. See, we forget that she was living now a century ago, and that that century was quite a different one from ours. We are now living practically already no more in a material age, but in a mental age, where the mental forces are being explored widely, very widely. And so we have to see very clear, more clearly than at her time, about this very point. Can't we govern the body through anything else but principle? Aren't there other mental forces that can change the body? It says, mesmerism says that their subjects cannot act voluntarily. Therefore, you need to have a mesmerist or a hypnotist that can act for the patient, and so that the patient himself is no more in a position to handle themselves or himself properly. She says, well, that's so. That is actually so. Your mesmerist, the hypnotist, can really show that very clearly. And that is so as long as their beliefs are not better instructed. It shows that the patient who believes in mesmerism and hypnotism will react under the mesmeric influence as long as he's not better instructed. And you hear now the great tone of principle that teaches and instructs and needs to be instructed. She says, therefore, hypnotism is not scientific, because science cannot produce both disorder and order, whereas mesmerism can do that. And we know that mesmerism can produce health and sickness. It can change the body the way it likes to change it. It can say to the body, now you freeze, and it can say the next moment, now you are hot. It can make, through malpractice, the patient sick, and it can make, through mesmeric influence, the patient well, as long as the patient is not instructed in science. So the mesmeric theories is a dualistic theory that can affect both things, good and evil, whereas science cannot do that. In science, we cannot use science to do something evil. We cannot use science to produce sickness.